In addition to the Middle East, there was another regional war during your presidency that could well have embroiled the big powers, and that was the war between India and West Pakistan over Bangladesh, what had been East Pakistan. How closely was the United States involved in that particular conflict?
With regard to Pakistan and India, we can cover it very briefly. In the first phase of the Pakistan-India clash, Pakistan clearly was the party that has to take the major responsibility and blame because of the cruelty with which they put down the Bangladesh East Pakistan rebellion. As a result of that, this brought India into the conflict. And India, despite warnings from us and we think even from the Soviet Union, declared war on Pakistan, or didn't declare war on Pakistan. They entered Bangladesh, fighting the Pakistan army in Bangladesh, without a declaration of war. Now, we have simply Bangladesh involved. In the meantime, messages are going back and forth between the United States and Moscow. We ask tell the Russians how important it is for them to restrain the Indians. They tell us how important it is for the Pakistanis to give up East Pakistan. And there were a number of issues. But in any event, we both got across to each other our points of view. And our point of view was very strongly stated that we thought that if the Russians allowed their client, India, using Soviet arms to destroy Pakistan, both East and West, that this would imperil our future relationship. And we put it down just as hard as that. Now, what happened was that after the Bangladesh phase of it began to be worked out, even though India, as you recall, would not adhere to a UN ceasefire resolution there, then from a source that we consider to be totally reliable, we learned that Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, in a meeting of her cabinet, had directed that a military operation be put in place to attack West Pakistan. And we had, as I said, information that we knew was completely reliable. It was then that we made the move that we did make. It was then I ordered the carrier task force into the Indian Ocean. We sent a very sharp note, of course, to the Russians. The Indians, according to the Russians, this was Brezhnev's, I thought, rather weak response. He says, well, they're very difficult to deal with. We find that our influence on them at this point, once they have tasted the victory in East Pakistan, is very little. But I knew that we had to help try to save West Pakistan. Now, unless we had brought pressure to bear on the Russians, unless we had basically conditioned our continued progress toward the summit, detente, etc., on their restraining their clients, and we, of course, by the same token, would restrain, to the extent we could, the Pakistanis, who didn't need to be restrained. They were defeated. Unless that had happened, I believe that she would have taken West Pakistan. She would have gobbled it up, and that would have had dramatic consequences, an effect on the Chinese, effect on American-Soviet relations, for reasons that I've mentioned, as well as, of course, the point is it would have been wrong. And totally wrong. And so basically, we saved West Pakistan because it was right. We also saved it, it's true, because it had something to do with our China initiative. The Chinese were putting a lot of pressure on us to do something. They couldn't do anything. They didn't want to get involved in a war with India at that point, although they had utter contempt for the
United States. And they would test later. They were testing the United States a bit to see
what we did. And saving West Pakistan built up a lot of credibility with the Chinese.
And you're really sure that your source was right, that she was seriously planning to invade West Pakistan?
I am totally sure.
We've talked a lot about your dealings with Brezhnev, and we've talked about the various material confrontations and so on with him, but we haven't really talked about what your impressions and memories of Brezhnev as a man was. What sort of a man was Brezhnev to deal with?
Let me compare him with Khrushchev, because I think people have a more vivid picture of Khrushchev, even today, people of our generation at least, than they do of Brezhnev. Khrushchev was boorish, crude, brilliant, ruthless, potentially rash. Terrible inferiority complex. I'll never forget one time at Camp David when we were up there with Eisenhower, that they were trying to make pleasant conversation at lunch, and Eisenhower asked Khrushchev where he went for his vacations. He says he went to the Crimea, and Khrushchev Eisenhower said, well, he didn't like the seashore so well. He liked to go to the desert. And Eisenhower said, the only trouble with vacations is that you have can't get away from the telephones. You've always got the telephone. Translation was made, and Khrushchev blew up, angry. He says, we've got telephones in the Soviet Union, too. We've got more telephones than you have. Well, in any event, that's typical of what we ran into. With Brezhnev, you had a man not as quick as Khrushchev intellectually. A man far better mannered than Khrushchev. A man who did not have the inferiority complex. Even though he knew they were inferior in certain ways, he knew, as Khrushchev did not know, that the Soviet Union by that time, when Brezhnev was in power, was frankly dealing equally across the table, whereas Khrushchev knew he was behind and therefore had to put on this big bravado act, the big macho act, to prove that he was ahead of everybody and everything. Another difference is, and this appears to be not too important, but it's interesting, Khrushchev tried to put on the air of being just a common peasant-like person. He would dress with a sloppy hat, and a collar wouldn't be too clear, and this and that, or clean. Whereas Brezhnev was somewhat of a fashion plate. He liked beautiful cars, he liked beautiful women, a small thing. Brezhnev, Podgorny, and Kosygin all wore cufflinks. None of the Soviet Party in 1959 wore cufflinks. Things had changed. The new class in the Soviet Union is doing pretty good. When I said that he was cautious, I would not like to leave the impression that he was timid. I think that he had read and practices the doctrine of Lenin, which is, as you may recall, probe with bayonets. If you encounter mush, proceed. If you encounter steel, withdraw. And that's the way Brezhnev would be. But I remember one incident that perhaps tells Brezhnev's deeper sense better than anything else. I'll never forget the day that we were riding on his yacht. And his yacht makes that old Sequoia that President Carter is now putting mothballs look like a rowboat next to a 100-foot yacht. But anyway, here's this marvelous Russian Navy yacht, and we had a beautiful luncheon on the yacht with the other members of the party, with caviar and champagne and everything else. And as we went up the tour up by the Black Sea, he pointed out Yalta. He pointed to where Roosevelt had stayed and where Stalin had stayed and where Churchill had stayed. We were sitting in the bow of the yacht, I'm an old Navy man. So the bow is the rear end, isn't it?
Probably.
That's right. No, the stern. We were sitting in the stern.
Let's say end.
All right. We were sitting down at the end of the yacht, in the back of the yacht, together. And as he pointed this out to me, all of a sudden, impulsively, he reached over and grabbed me. He was kind of like Johnson that way. He likes to grab people. He and Johnson would have had a lot of fun. They're much alike. And he put his arm around me, and he said, "You know, my friend, President Nixon," he said, "I only hope the day will come when every Russian and every American can sit together as we are sitting now, and we can be friends."
When you first selected Henry Kissinger for the NSC, did you expect him to become, and the NSC to become, but did you expect him to become as much of a international star as he did? I mean, or did you intend it originally to be a backroom role?
No, I don't think I expected it, and I don't think he expected it either. However, I knew that we were going to deal with great events. I didn't know at the time I met him. I didn't know enough about his background. I didn't know him enough personally to know what a dramatic impact his personality would have as he executed his role quite brilliantly.
You must have had disagreements, I suppose. What were the most important ones?
I'm a fatalist, basically. Kissinger is more, despite his enormous intellectual capability, is one who is perhaps somewhat less fatalistic and or determinist in his views, more emotional, interestingly enough. Although I, too, have emotions. I tend to hide them, perhaps, more than he does, or to submerge them or suppress them. But be that as it may, we won't try to psychoanalyze each other at the moment. But Kissinger, I will remember, after we went into Cambodia, he was for going in. But here, I made a decision on a spot, which we had not discussed before. He wondered about it at the time, but he totally supported it once it was made. Then came Kent State, which was a terrible emotional shock to me and a very great shock to Kissinger. But I remember right after that, Henry came in one day and he said, "You know, I'm not sure that we should have gone into this Cambodian thing. And perhaps now has come the time that we should shorten the time and get out a little sooner." He wasn't seriously considering it, but he says, "I think," and he used to always preface it by saying, "I must warn you, Mr. President, that the situation that I hear from my colleagues from the colleges and universities is very, very serious, and Cambodia is it could have been a mistake." And then I said, "Henry," I said, "we've done it." I said, "Remember Lot's wife. Never look back." I don't know whether Henry'd read the Old Testament or not, but I had. And he got the point. Henry and I often had a little joke between us after that. Whenever he would come in and say, "Well, I'm not sure we should have done this or that or the other thing," I would say, "Henry, remember Lot's wife." And that would end the conversation.
How many times did he come in and say that maybe he should resign?
Maybe a half a dozen.
Half a dozen times.
That's right. But to others, more often. He would talk to Haig and to Haldeman about this. And this was when he would be in fights with the bureaucracy. He couldn't stand the bureaucratic infighting. He had differences, as you know, with Secretary Rogers. And incidentally, this was a very painful thing for me because Rogers had been my friend. He was a personal friend. Henry, of course, was not a personal friend. We were associates, but not personal friends. Not enemies, but not personal friends. Rogers is a personal friend. But Henry was fighting him. First, they were two very proud men. They were two very intelligent men. There could be only one person to handle some of these major issues, and where secrecy was involved, I mean, secret negotiations, it had to be Henry in the areas like Vietnam, China, Russia, in the Mideast. Now, in the case of Rogers, on the other hand, being a very proud man, he did not resent Henry handling such things, but he objected to the fact that Henry got too much credit, was taking too much credit. And also, he objected, and here I think he had a good case, and I think Henry would have to agree, that he, Rogers, who had to make public statements all the time and testify and answer questions before the Congress, wasn't informed about things. He wanted to be informed. Well, Henry would come to me, and we had several arguments about it. He would say, I will not inform Rogers because he'll leak. I said, Henry, and I must have told him this a dozen times, I said, Henry, the State Department bureaucracy will leak. It always has. It always will. I said, but Bill Rogers will never leak if I tell him that it's in confidence. Well, I'm not so sure. See, he didn't know Rogers as well as I did. I knew that Rogers was a man of honor, and I knew he wouldn't leak. And that was why on the China Initiative, for example, we had quite an argument about that. Henry didn't want to tell anybody, of course, except those on a need-to-know basis. And I said, Rogers has got to know. He says, well, he'll leak, or he'll object to it. I said, you cannot have the Secretary of State not be informed, because he has got to take off the day that announcement was made. Incidentally, that announcement took 3.5 minutes when I announced that trip to China on July the 15th, 1971. But Rogers immediately had to call ambassadors all over and heads of state all over the world, and Henry, of course, made a few calls, and I made 2 or 3.
Did Henry say that he'd resign if John Coligny was appointed Secretary of State?
Not to me. I have read reports to that effect, and I do know that that his views with regard to Coligny were mixed. He respected him as a political leader. However, I think Henry saw in Coligny, let's face it, a potential rival. Coligny, basically, everything that Coligny touches in the political area, Coligny controls. Henry's the same kind of a person. And so Coligny would be a very formidable fellow to have around. And also, you have to remember that Henry, to his credit, was loyal to his former patron, and still his patron, Nelson Rockefeller, and he felt that building Coligny up might be not in the interest of Nelson Rockefeller. But as far as his discussion with me, he never said to me, look, if Coligny is appointed Secretary of State, I'll resign, or if you name Coligny as the vice presidential nominee, I'll resign, or anything like that. I could sense that he would have preferred somebody else, let's put it that way.
Were you actually considering John Coligny as Secretary of State?
Yes. I thought he would have made a very good Secretary of State. However, in this case, while Henry did not have a veto power, nobody can have a veto power where the president is concerned, any president. But while he didn't have a veto power, it was indispensable that whoever was Secretary of State be able to work with Henry, and Henry be able to work with him, because he had his fingers in so many pies, which were in various stages of development, and consequently, we couldn't possibly have a situation where he'd be at odds. In other words, I had gone through the Rogers-Kissinger feud for 4 years, and I didn't want to buy another feud with another Secretary of State for the rest of the 4 years. And that's why I finally gave Henry both hats, which I, in retrospect, probably would not have done could we have found some individual who would be Henry's equal, or that he would consider his equal intellectually, and yet Henry would not feel was a competitor who would threaten his position of being the president's major foreign policy advisor.
Dustin Hoffman once made a film called Who is Harry Kellerman, and why is he saying all those terrible things about me? It was called. Now, as you read accounts, knowing what a successful working relationship you had in many areas of remarks attributed to Henry Kissinger, whether it's in the New Republic or at that Ottawa banquet or whatever, you must sometimes feel, you know who Henry Kissinger is, but didn't you sometimes feel, why is he saying all those terrible things about me?
Well, to answer the question quite candidly, it drives my family right up the wall. And it's only because it bothers them that it would bother me at all. After such accounts appear, I know that I always get a call from Henry on the phone explaining that that there's been either a misquotation or misinterpretation or what have you. And I have always said to him, forget it. I said, if what your opinion of me is not however you express it, it isn't going to affect our relationship unless you express it to me personally. I mean, what you say about me to other people isn't going to bother me. That's what I said. But in all candor, I would have to admit my family didn't share that. And I think what we have to understand, too, is that Henry likes to say outrageous things. He's kind of like Alice Longworth that way. She, as she puts it, she says, you know, I like to be naughty sometimes. I like to say things that are devilish. And Henry was not really exactly that way. In fact, it was quite different. But he basically, as an intellectual, is not typical in this sense. Most people with great intellectual ability couldn't care less about the so-called Hollywood celebrity set or celebrities of any kind. I mean, basically, they're only interested in a person's brains and not particularly whether or not they have a lot of money or a lot of good news clippings or what have you. Henry, on the other hand, was fascinated first by the celebrity set, and second, he liked being one himself. Not at first, but people would start coming up for his autograph, and he was invited more and more to the Hollywood parties and the rest, but be that as it may, so he goes to a party, and I can see exactly what happened in Canada. He runs into a lady who has a very low opinion of me, and so Henry feels that really he's defending me, and that the way that best to defend is to concede that, he's sort of an odd person, he's an artificial person, and so forth and so on and so on. And the only problem was that he didn't think to turn the microphone off. But on the other hand, I didn't turn it off either in the Oval Office on occasion, so I never held it for that.